Ulterior.
So they're talking about one gorilla versus 100 men. Bro, there is no debate. There is no argument. There is no point of any of that discourse because the gorilla is taking each and every one of their fucking legs and dismembering them. What the fuck do you think is gonna happen? It's not some fucking chimpanzee. It's a fucking silverback gorilla, bro. What the fuck are you talking about? And while I'm on the subject of what the fuck are motherfuckers talking about and what are they doing nowadays, the Cleveland Browns and the NFL draft last week. All right, first of all, they dropped from number 2 down to number 5 with the Jacksonville Jaguars in a trade in which Cleveland takes a first-round pick next year from Jacksonville. All right, that's fine. That's cool and all. You move down from number 2 where you could have had Travis Hunter, and instead you go to 5 and you get Mason Graham. All right, fine, whatever. Jacksonville gets Travis Hunter. Cleveland gets Mason Graham. It is what it is. All right. At the start of the second round, they have two picks, numbers 33 and 36. At 33, I'm thinking, okay, they're getting Luther Burden as a third. Maybe they get Jaden Higgins. Who knows what's going to happen? They take Carson Schwechinger, linebacker out of UCLA. Fine, whatever. That lets the Texans, my fucking Texans, trade or capitalize on that trade with the Giants in the first round and take Jaden Higgins at 34. Love it. Tremendous. At 36, Cleveland takes Quinshon Judkins, Ohio State running back, over Trevion Henderson, who then goes at 38 to the Patriots. It's a little bit weird, I can't lie. I will get to some of the other weird shit that happened in the draft in a second, but I'm talking about the Cleveland Browns right now because in the third round, they took Dylan Gabriel. Oregon quarterback Dylan Gabriel. And this is at a point in the draft where not only is Shedeur Sanders still there, but so is Quinn Ewers. And I don't give a fuck what anybody says about Quinn Ewers. He is a competent quarterback. Did he have some fuck-ups? Yes, but a lot of quarterbacks last year in college did. Quinn at least was able to help Texas get to the semifinals of the college football playoffs. Quinn is a very competent quarterback, but the Browns took Dylan Gabriel. And we continue to see Shedeur Sanders fall, and that is the story heading into the fourth round and the remainder of the draft on Saturday. And then finally, Cleveland pulls the trigger, and they do the damn thing, and they take Shedeur Sanders in the fifth round after already having taken Dylan Gabriel in the third round. I have no idea what the Browns are doing. I have no idea what came about for any sort of like discussion or conversation within their front office and their war room about taking two quarterbacks in this draft. It's fucking insane that this actually happened. And now we're going to talk about the other quarterback situations here in the draft because, okay, Cam Ward goes 1 to the Titans. Everybody knew that. That was a given and a formality. I love Cam Ward. I think he had a great season with Miami. And I don't need him to do too well with Tennessee because they're in the same division as Houston. But I hope that it works out in the long run for him and that team because it kind of needs to for their sake. Giants trade back into the first round at number 25 with the Texans. And with that pick, the Giants took fucking, what's bro's name again? Jackson Dart. That's his fucking name. Jackson Dart. And you know what? Good on Dart. I would not have done that. I saw some of Ole Miss last season. Yeah, he's alright, you know? Did y'all see that fucking video with John Gruden where Gruden's like, show me your snap count, and Dart's like, alright, here we go. And then Gruden's like, no, the snap count. And he's like, yeah. Alright, bro. Yeah, whatever. And once the Giants took Dart, you start thinking like, okay, Shedeur has to be the next quarterback taken. Maybe it's the Saints with pick 40. Pick 40 comes, I'm watching the TV, and they say Tyler Shug. Tyler Shug! I was so fucking flabbergasted, bro. And from there, you know, everybody did their thing, and it was a very weird draft, but when I think about what the Texans did with their picks, I am mostly content with it. Jaden Higgins, Arianti Ursary, Jalen Knoll, Jalen Smith, Jalen Reed, you know, Luke Lachey with the final pick. These are good. I like these. These will work out. Especially that Higgins and Knoll, Iowa State connection, and Knoll playing the slant receiver the same way that Tankdale did. That's fire. We got something there. We took Graham Mertz, Florida quarterback. Really, bro? That dude? We took him over Quinn Ewers? I don't know about that one. I really, really don't know about that one. But you know, we'll see what happens. Kind of disappointing that the team missed out on Kelvin Banks and Matthew Golden and Gunnar Helm from all from Texas, but you know, it is what it is. It's the draft. It happens. We'll live, we'll ball, we'll move forward. And yeah, that took me like 5 whole minutes to get through. If you do not care about football and you listen to all that, you're a fucking real one. Thank you. And I will be getting into the music shortly. So for this episode, we have new singles by the likes of Sleep Token, Dayseeker, Gucci High Waters, and a few others that I want to make mention of. And then 2 brand new albums by Watch Me Rise and Landmarks. Thank you guys so much for tapping in, and I really hope you guys enjoy this episode. Yeah, so because that whole intro took 5 minutes, I have nothing to get through besides these songs and albums, so I will jump right into that now. The first single up for the episode is one that I have a lot to say about, maybe not so much right now, but when the time comes, definitely. We're going to talk about Damocles by Sleep Token. Now, because we are only 1 week away from the release of Even in Arcadia, which I do anticipate doing a special review episode for when that time comes around, I do not know how much I want to dive into right now as it relates to my overall thoughts about Damocles. What I will say, and I'm going to preface this by acknowledging that I do have a tendency of being hyperbolic at times when talking about music that means a lot to me. The first time that I heard Damocles last week, I was sitting in a coffee shop, kind of isolated in a corner of the interior, not necessarily by choice, that's kind of just what the environment ended up being that day. The song started, and just that immediate mixture of the piano keys and Vessel's voice, it like genuinely started to move me. Like, to an incredible extent emotionally, and then once the chorus hit, and Vessel is giving lines like, "When the river runs dry and the curtain is called, how will I know if I can't see the bottom?" I started to expand my thoughts beyond just questioning if Damocles is the best song of the year, so far at least, and into the territory of, is Damocles one of the greatest songs in the history of the scene? Again, hyperbolic, but I'm being genuine with you guys right now. And the reasoning for that doesn't just stop at the way the song sounds or the emotions that it makes me feel, but also, like, imagining the weight that it has on Vessel and the other members of Sleep Token, because it feels like the most personal song they've ever put out. A song that isn't rooted in, like, fantasy or lore, but rather the reality that they have had to endure because of the success of the band over the last few years. It's similar to Caramel a lot in that aspect, but just the way that this narrative is expressed in Damocles, it's where, like, that connection is established from myself to this single. And I do not want to get too ahead of myself when talking about how vulnerable Sleep Token comes across, because there is an entire record that is almost 1 hour long where I think they're going to explore that subject matter to an even greater length than they already have. Where I will leave off with Damocles for right now is that this song inspires beauty and sadness in one go, in a way that feels transcendent of what this scene even is, and that is the absolute fucking power that Sleep Token hold now. And now I move on to another single that I also have a lot to say and get off my chest about. We got brand new Dayseeker for the first time in a fucking minute. This is Pale Moonlight. So, this is how we're going to do it. This is how we'll do this part. Every week, I do Scenic Overlook, which is that thing on Instagram and Twitter where I rank my 10 favorite songs from the week, and then they go into a playlist, and it's like this whole ordeal that I've tried to make feel like a big deal within the confines and lore of this whole platform. And every song that is ranked number one each and every week gets a guaranteed spot in the top 100 songs of the year list that comes out annually in December. And what I will say is that by the end of 2025, I would imagine that it is going to look a little bit crazy seeing some of the songs that have guaranteed spots and knowing that Pale Moonlight is not one of them. And like, I'm not throwing shade at anybody, because if you have been a number one song so far this year for Scenic Overlook, you earned it and you deserved it, and I will be happy to talk about you in December. But Pale Moonlight is better than, let's say, 95% of songs that have been number one this year. You know, possibly any other week so far this year, this song gets a number one spot, like with a fucking bullet. But it just so happened to be released the same week as Damocles. And genuinely, guys, I tried in my head to rationalize any scenario where I thought Pale Moonlight is a better song or a more impactful song at this moment than Damocles, and I couldn't do it. So because of that, Pale Moonlight has to exist on an island separate from those Scenic Overlook winning songs, but the island it's on is still one that it encompasses all to itself, because for as detailed and extraordinary as the discography of Dayseeker is, I have spent the last week or so believing firmly in my head and heart that this is the best Dayseeker song I've ever listened to. It feels like the right step following Dark Sun, which I did like, but maybe didn't love in hindsight. It has the kind of aggression and dark tone that makes me really curious for what the next era of Dayseeker is going to sound like. It is a massive song. It has all of the potential in the world to further catapult Dayseeker. I think Rory Rodriguez's screams and cleans are fucking precise and on point. This is a magnificent song, and again, it's going to look crazy when we get to December for Ulterior, and I have to reiterate that this was not the song of the week when it dropped, solely and strictly because it shared a release week with Damocles. We have a brand new single from Gucci High Waters en route to his new album, This Is Nobody Else. And that album is Death by Desire, dropping at the end of this month on May 30th. For basically all of the singles rollout before this track, I was either inactive with podcasting or I just overlooked whatever single of his was out, which, you know, does happen at times. But there was no way for me to overlook Nobody Else, because I think this song is the embodiment of what it is about Gucci High Waters that, you know, made me a big fan of his some years ago now. I think the flow and rhythm of the single captures that sort of like emo and R&B driven style of Gucci High Waters music just so effortlessly well. It's very catchy while still retaining a sense of dread. And even the way that Gucci High Waters kind of expands his range in the chorus, I think really factors into what it is about this single that I think makes it work tremendously well. And it definitely adds to the level of excitement that I already had about the release of Death by Desire. Another act who is gearing up to drop a new album very soon, Senna delivered on another single in the form of Drunk Dial Anthem. Tell me it's fine. Tell me it's all right. Now, I do not know if I've ever made mention before of the release date or details for this Senna album, but it is called Stranger to Love, and it will be dropping on May 23rd. May is quite stacked, is it not? A lot for us to look forward to, and I think Senna has done nothing but make a strong case for why they belong in the conversation for most anticipated upcoming releases for that batch. There's like this groove to Drunk Dial Anthem that I would say channels a few different acts, or at least that's kind of what came to my mind throughout my first listens. The guitar work in the intro and choruses and the bridge makes me think of Polyphia, specifically on Renaissance. So, you know, immediately that's an aspect that's going to make me turn my head and like pay attention to what's going on over here. The rhythm inspires a similar feeling that I get listening to bands like Don Broco or The Home Team. You know, those kind of bands who have that real dance factor to what they do. I think that's an area that Senna tapped into effectively with Drunk Dial Anthem. And all throughout the singles rollout for this record, I've just been captivated time and time again by Senna. And I know that the finished product of Stranger to Love is going to do the same to me. The final single that I will go into detail on comes from a band that I have described before as the most important band of my lifetime, for myself at least. It is Linkin Park with the brand new song Unshatter. So this is one of the three new tracks that will be on the deluxe edition of From Zero, dropping on May 16th. From Zero was the 2024 record of the year for Ulterior, and I have not changed my stance on that in the 4 months that have passed since doing the year-end festivities for the show. And I think Unshatter fits in really well with that track list for the fact that it's not a groundbreaking song. It doesn't reinvent the sound of Linkin Park or anything like that. But it carries with it the heart and soul of this band that I thought was accentuated on From Zero. Like, it's very easy to imagine myself listening to this song as, that six-year-old kid who discovered Linkin Park more than 2 decades ago and loved it back then, the same way that I do now. I think Emily continues to be a shining star for this iteration of the band, and she sounds impeccable all throughout it. And ultimately, just the sheer fact that I can go about a week and then there's randomly a new Linkin Park track dropping is something that I never ever want to take for granted, because for a long while, I didn't think that would ever happen. These were the remaining singles from last week that I gave either a 4 or a 5 to in the reviews on social media. The Thin Line by A Small District, Severing by Abyss Watching Me, Anxiously Walking on Water by Angel Number, Better Off by Archers, The Weight by Arm's Length, Forever the Night by Bury Tomorrow, Against the Parade by Dark Signal, No Tomorrow by Fit for a King, Monochrome by From Joy, No Second Chances by Hell Can Wait, Blitz by 100th, Heavy Hearts by Mayflower, Reflections by Melrose Avenue, Eat My Heart Out by Outsider Heart, Got Another Lover by Palmist, The Portal by Psychoframe, New World by Revnoir, Pill to Swallow by Soft Cult, I Hope You Let Go by Some Hurt Trouble, Liquid Love by Straight Shot Home, Ending Scene by TSS, Blue and Cold by Teeth, Let It In by Teeth, Infinity by the band Camino, and Seasons by We Came From Wolves. There were actually a handful of singles this time around that either didn't really do much for me or I just straight up really disliked. Popsicle by Lilith Czar. I think Lilith's voice on this track is incredible, but some of the creative and structural choices I don't think really suit what it is about her that I think works. One Missed Call by Everyone Dies in Utah. I do not know if I've ever actually been impressed by Everyone Dies in Utah, and what they have going for them on this song, it's kind of like that like 2000s metalcore, like rise core kind of a throwback style. I don't think it worked for them back then, and I still don't think it works now. Vacan by Awaken I Am. I think it just sounds like kind of lifeless in some portions of it. And I say that as somebody who actually has really enjoyed some of Awaken I Am's material before in the past. Let's see. There was also Vigilantes by Wargasm. I think I'm just kind of over Wargasm and like their identity and their sound. It's not bad. It's just like, I feel like I've heard it enough times already from them, and there's not really anything that they're doing to, like, you know, reinvigorate that sound for them. And then there is Glory by Our Last Night. It's funny, man. It's like, whenever I mention Our Last Night now on this show, and I think I've mentioned them, like, a couple episodes straight now, it's kind of just been to say that I think their output this year is, like, pretty bad. So I don't want to continue to bully them. It's just like, I don't know, man. I it sucks. So now we move on to the two albums for this episode. The first of which I think is more of a low-key release for a lot of you guys listening. I am unsure how many of you have awareness to this album or this band. But what I hope is that after y'all hear me speak about this album and why I think it is fantastic, you guys take the time to check it out yourselves. It is the debut full-length album by Watch Me Rise called A Decade Full of Setbacks and Mistakes. So I can tell you guys exactly how Watch Me Rise made their way onto my radar, because I vividly remember this for whatever reason. It was back in 2023, and there was a week where I didn't really have any records lined up for reviews on that week's episode. So what I did was, instead of just being like, hey guys, there's no album or EP for this week for me to review, so here's just a bunch of singles, I started scavenging social media for whatever new alternative releases I could find to talk about, and somehow, some way, I discovered Watch Me Rise's EP that was brand new at the time called Bedtime Stories. And a lot of what I am going to speak about in a minute for A Decade Full of Setbacks and Mistakes was first made apparent to me on that EP, which is that this is a band that understands what goes into making emo and post-hardcore music feel inspiring in this day and age. Like, immediately, I felt this sense of emotion and grittiness to the music that made me want to keep tabs on this band and see where they went from there. And where they went was this album that I gravitated to right away, A Decade Full of Setbacks and Mistakes. When you start this record, the first song you hear is Calico. And it starts off with these guitar chords that sound distorted, but like not really. It's kind of a little bit of a weird sound to try explaining. But then the rest of the band starts to work their way in, and by the time Calico really erupts and you get the full scope of Watch Me Rise's magic, I really think that if post-hardcore in this fashion is something that you're interested in and seeking out, it should be very easy to navigate what this record is about and find solace in it. I think even with these tracks having an edge to them, they're still incredibly catchy and rhythmic. Like, I can't listen to something like Maladaptive without nodding my head or tapping my foot. Murad is another giant song that I keep returning to, and I think it feels like the centerpiece to this record at some points. There is a song that comes in at the halfway point of the album called I Thought You Were Stronger, which is this instrumental piece that I think could have had some risk factor involved, because the vocals are one of the key elements to this album's success, in my opinion. And when you take that away from a song, it's kind of a gamble as to how that's going to work. But because of the musicianship of Watch Me Rise, I Thought You Were Stronger ended up being one of my favorite songs on this record, and the instrumentation finds a way to wield that same level of emotion and somberness that the other tracks do. it's genuinely a remarkable achievement, and I hope that the members of Watch Me Rise understand how impactful a song like this can be for listeners, even with it being instrumental. There were plenty more standout moments in the second half of the album, like on Resign and Solace Grace. Yet, even by the time someone makes it all the way to the end for the closing song In Red, the way that song starts off still has this chilling feeling to it that like, you know, at least for myself, it made me lock in and be like, oh, this is really the end of this journey. This really is the culmination to this very layered and heartstring tugging story that I've been invested in. And from that perspective, I think In Red concludes the record on one of its strongest notes. A Decade Full of Setbacks and Mistakes is the kind of album that is going to sit you down and, I don't want to say like make you, you know, think about any of your own mistakes or setbacks over not even the last decade, but maybe like a lifetime. But what I am saying is that for myself and the multiplicity of times that I have listened to this album from front to back the last couple days now, I cannot help but just put myself in the position of this album's artwork, where there are these leaves and branches that are kind of in the way of what looks to be, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel. And listening to this album, it is kind of like me trying to, you know, work my way through all that debris to get to the light. And even if maybe like I don't find myself at that light, I understand at least that there is an album out there for me to connect with on my search for that light. And that's what A Decade Full of Setbacks and Mistakes has been to me ever since then. And I would imagine it's going to be that to me for the rest of the year, the rest of my life even. I think A Decade Full of Setbacks and Mistakes by Watch Me Rise really is that kind of an album that you can take with you and you can grow with it and you can, you know, mold yourself to these songs, because that's kind of what it's meant to achieve. And again, these songs have such a weight to them that even if they're hard to listen to at times, I cannot pull myself away from these songs. I cannot pull myself away from this album. And at large, I cannot pull myself away from Watch Me Rise. And now for the second and final album for the episode. This is a long time coming. It has been more than a few years now, as far as like the waiting period for this record. It is The Darkest Place I've Ever Been by Landmarks. So this is the second album by Landmarks to be reviewed on Ulterior. The last one was 2021's Lost in the Waves, which had a release that coincided with the time period that this podcast started. So Lost in the Waves ended up being one of the first albums I ever talked about. And like, okay, now that I think about it, it wasn't even really a review in that sense. It was mentioned on an episode where I talked about my 10 favorite bands of March 2021, and then again at the end of the year when it ranked, I believe, 12th in the standings for record of the year. And since then, my adoration for Landmarks has only grown, because I've just gone through these spells of listening to, you know, not just Lost in the Waves, but also Fantasy. And then I got to see them on Metalcore Dropouts in 2023. So even without a new album by Landmarks, there have been plenty of opportunities for me to connect with them even further, and I have taken advantage of these opportunities because I love Landmarks. Where the rollout for The Darkest Place I've Ever Been kind of unofficially began was with the release of Creature back in January 2024. And that song releasing in January very much so did make me think that there would be something of a larger release from Landmarks in some sort by the end of that year. But instead, we didn't actually get an update on anything new until literally December, when The Darkest Place I've Ever Been was announced. And we got the double single of Sulfur and Samurai 16, which does bring me now to the way that this rollout was conducted, because I have seen it be mentioned on social media, and I do agree that it was a little bit weird, if not very weird. We got a line in the dust at the end of January, and then Blood Red at the end of February, and that was it. A 2-month separation between the final single and the full album, which I think for some listeners very well could have strained the anticipation of the album. For myself, I was in the mindset of just let Landmarks cook. Because even if this is not at all how I would have done the singles rollout, these songs were fucking incredible. And ultimately, it didn't really matter to me how we were going to get to the album so long as we did. Another thing about the singles rollout is that, and I might just be making this up to be honest, but I think that when Sulfur and Samurai 16 dropped, I talked about Sulfur, but I kind of just brushed off Samurai 16. And the reason wasn't because I didn't like it, but rather I liked it so much that I felt slighted by it being only 1 minute and 10 seconds. It's the only like non-metalcore song on this record. Okay, well, kind of. We'll get to the other one later on. It's more hip-hop driven than anything else. I think it is incredible in every facet. I really enjoy the rhythm that Flo has in his voice here. It reminds me of this video game, and I have no idea if I'm speaking to anybody who knows what I'm talking about, but an Atlas game called Catherine. That game has a soundtrack that is kind of like filled with songs that sound like Samurai 16, and it puts me in that environment whenever I listen to it. And since I just mentioned Flo, I will add that there are some parts of the record where his vocal affliction reminds me of Phil Bozeman from Whitechapel. Like, he sounds fucking demonic at times, like on this one part of Requiem where he starts screaming over a blast beat, and it gives off that kind of a vibe to me. I think the title track that starts off the album gives you a clear vision of his range and versatility, because he starts off very mellowly and then gradually raises his voice up until the point where the rest of the band comes in and delivers on one of the best opening songs all year so far, and a song that I think is very easy to imagine kicking off sets for them in the future. Some of my favorite songs ever by Landmarks exist on this record, and I'll single out La Valse du Temps as the prime example of that. And beyond just Flo's voice, what also sticks out to me on that song is how unified the band sounds, and the way that the instrumentation feels like it's potentially the most refined that Landmarks has ever sounded as a unit. The closing song on this album is the most emotional and like atmospherically heavy song that they have ever written, Funeral, which is almost like 3 minutes of Flo sounding really vulnerable and defeated while his voice is accompanied by this absolutely beautiful and stunning piano track. It's such a distant sound from the rest of The Darkest Place I've Ever Been, but it works so well still, and it becomes a large part of why this record is an ultimate success. And that does bring me to a concluding point, because I did see a tweet comparing this record to Lost in the Waves, and more specifically debating that it is a better album. As of right now, what I will say is I don't really think it's better than Lost in the Waves, and that's why it got a 9.5 and not a 10 in the social media review. But I also want to make this point to you guys. I have had 4 years to live with Lost in the Waves. As of this recording, I am on day 5 of listening to The Darkest Place I've Ever Been. Considering how much Lost in the Waves means to me, I don't think there's any way for The Darkest Place I've Ever Been to like immediately flip my opinion on what is the best release by Landmarks. Now, in the future, can it become my favorite Landmarks album? Yes, absolutely. Because this album is fucking incredible and I love it so much. But Lost in the Waves, like, that shit means something to me, you know? And again, I'm not saying that this album cannot, but just in comparison to Lost in the Waves, that album has such a stranglehold on me that it will definitely take a few more listens and, you know, time to elapse for me to really think about how it is I believe The Darkest Place I've Ever Been compares to Lost in the Waves. But without that comparison and just looking at this body of work for what it is, which is the identity of landmarks in 2025, this album fucking rocks. And I continue to find myself to be amazed by landmarks at every turn. And that's it. That was every album and single for this past week for me to get through. As far as like what I would say you guys can expect in the future for the next few weeks, I am looking to get like a regular episode out next week. And then after that, when even an Arcadia by Sleep Token comes out, there will be an episode dedicated to just that. I cannot say for certain if there will be any other releases in May or even June where that is going to happen, where there is like, you know, one review for one episode. But we'll see what happens from there. But definitely, you know, Sleep Token kind of is the centerpiece to what is going to be going on for this show in May. So look forward to that and look forward to whatever other happenings I dive into. If you guys made it all the way to the end of this episode, I really, really strongly and greatly appreciate each and every one of you. And I will talk to you guys when I talk to y'all again. Take care.